Welcome to Alternative Dog Moms Podcast. I'm Kimberly Gauthier, the creator of Keep the Tail Wagging. For the past 9 years, I've been blogging about raw feeding, pet wellness, and life as a crazy dog mom. I've seen massive improvements in my dog's health since I started raising my dogs naturally, and I'm passionate about sharing my experience to help other pet parents.
I'm Erin Scott. For the past 9 years, I've been researching and learning everything I can about healing cancer, allergies, autoimmune, and mystery illnesses in both my dogs and myself. And I can't wait to share with you everything I've learned on this journey. As the Alternative Dog Moms, we're bringing you all the latest dog health news that we're following and sharing the tips, tricks, and resources we learn along the way. Now, let's get started. Hello, Kimberly.
Hello, Erin. It feels like it's been so long since I've talked to you when it's only been last week.
It was a week and a day, and just that one day makes a difference from our usual schedule.
I was up at three in the morning with my earbuds in and my phone calling Portugal.
Oh.
Because to talk to a veterinarian in Portugal, because I have questions about Bobby, the longest living dog. And she offered to like clarify some things. And I was so excited because finally I tracked down someone who can answer my nerdy questions. But unfortunately, she wanted to do it via Zoom. And she's like, I'll send you a link. And I'm like, it's 3 o'clock in the morning. I can't do a Zoom call right now. So she said she would do it later in the day for me. But I think she was just sort of like 3 a.m. And I'm like, yeah, I really want this information. My alarm, everything. So that's why I'm really excited to have Dr. Roberts here.
Yes, we have Dr. Ruth Roberts with us today. How are you?
I am peachy, and I feel your pain, Kimberly, because I am on Central European time. So it's now 6:30 at night for me. So it gets interesting. But, you know, it was really interesting. I mean, so when we were at the Feed Real Summit, I was asking Rodney about Bobby, and he said, and you know, Bobby ate all boiled food, right? I'm like, yeah, because this is the way the Portuguese cook. And so if he was eating what they were eating, that's what he was eating. And they have about 17% of their diet is animal protein based. So if that helps you with the macronutrient ratios a little bit, yeah.
It does. I think that was a thing that got me is, you know, it's funny because social media is so hard in that it's so easy to misunderstand each other because, you know, we lack tone of voice, body language, facial expressions. So I had so many questions about Bobby, but people took it as I don't believe them. And it's like, no. I care less how old he is. He's clearly old. So whether he's 25 years old or 35 years old, I really don't care. My oldest dog lived to 13 and a half. So it's like, if I can somehow learn anything from that community that will get us over the hump of 13, you know, I have a friend of mine who has a mastiff who I think is 14 or 15. And Thomas Sandberg had a Great Dane. And I think his Great Dane lived until like 12 or 13 or 14, you know, so there are people who are feeding fresh food and doing these things. And so we're seeing these dogs that generally don't even make it to 10, or if they do make it to 10, it's like, this is it.
It's not pretty. Yeah. And
even my friend Kathy, she has a golden doodle there. I think their lifespan, I don't know what it is, but I think it's 12. And her golden doodle went up to 14.
Right on.
And she was feeding, you know, air dry food, but adding fresh food and stuff. So it's clear. And talking to her, her dog is also a therapy dog. So he goes to a hospital all day and walks around and stuff. So I think that having a job and moving, okay, we got to check. That's one thing that we need to do. So I'm just sort of like, no. I understand that he eats this great diet. I understand that he eats what his owners eat. I understand that he eats organic vegetables. What I want to know is, what is the soil like there compared to the soil like here? I mean, it's just sort of like these really specific questions that only someone who lives in Portugal could probably answer for me. And I know that I'm not going to be able to replicate. I know that Zoe probably is not going to be the next longest living dog in the world, but it's still just so fascinating, the things that we don't think about, because we focus so much on diet and we don't really talk about all the other things that go into it.
Right on. So, I mean, that's, you know, that's the big deal, right? So if we only focus on one thing, and let's say we're going to focus on food, for instance, but we spend our lives, or our dogs spend their lives sitting on the sofa the rest of the time, I think we've right. just severely neglected a really, really important part of what mm-hmm. makes that dog healthy. And so that's in the traditional medicine systems of traditional Chinese medicine, Ayurveda. It wasn't just one thing. It wasn't the herbs or the acupuncture or the yogas or whatever. It was a lifestyle. It was a life plan, really. And so it's food. It's eating what's appropriate for you, for your type, you know, and that's clearly defined in Ayurvedic and TCM. And then it's also exercise, mindfulness, being outside, being in contact with Mother Earth. And I think that was, you know, that's one of the other interesting things. Our dogs are inside so much, and yes. we have so much indoor air pollution. That's part of the issue. But I mean, to your point earlier, I think sadly, golden doodles are living to be 8 and 10. I mean, that's just awful.
Yeah.
For me, I've had several of my dogs as they get older. Actually, the last three dogs died at 16, 16 and a half, 16. And part of that is because they exercised a lot. They were outside. They were able to run and do normal dog stuff. So they were on the ground. They were eating. For me, I teach cooked food according to the traditional Chinese medicine sort of precepts. But again, whole food, fresh food. So I think all of those things are important. And then the other thing I really find too is that if we're so busy, us pet parents, pet moms are so busy looking at the phone, you know, if we're in this all the time and it's dinging and binging and our emotions are going all over the place because Facebook and other social media folks know how to manipulate our neurotransmitters, mm-hmm. for lack of a better descriptor, the dogs are taking that journey with us. And so if we never stop that and interrupt that pattern of being manipulated by what's going on in the electronic environment, our dogs never get a break from it either.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point, because I truly believe that our dogs soak in our energy. I don't know if I told you this, Aaron, but I used to have anxiety attacks, and I haven't had one in months, just probably 6 months. And I was just like, yes, I kicked it. And then probably, oh, it was before actually I went down to the Feed Real Summit. I had just like a horrible anxiety attack, and I haven't had one in so long that I didn't realize what it was. And Zoe came, she crawls into my lap and she's scratching at my chest and trying to touch my face. I have two other dogs on either side of me, just like in my face, and I'm trying to work. And I'm just like, what are you guys doing? Okay, let's go outside. But no one wanted to go outside, and they just kept at me. And when I started to feel better and they sort of calmed down, and then they just sort of went back to whatever they were doing before. And I realized, it's like, oh my gosh, I had an anxiety attack. You guys were trying to help me out. Thank you. But it was just sort of like, it was such a reminder that I didn't know what was going on, but they immediately picked up on it.
They're so attuned to us. Yeah.
I mean, it's like you think about, you know, the things that we think we're holding inside, you know, we're not really, it's being broadcast loud and clear.
Yeah, no, they're receiving it loud and clear. And so beautiful that they showed you so clearly and you were able to pick up on that, because I think a lot of people would be like, oh my God, they're just annoying the heck out of me again. What's going on, y'all? Come on, just let it go. But that's awesome, because now you know when they come up and do that again, if that were to happen in the future, you're like, oh, I need to take a deep breath and just go over here and do something else for a minute. Yeah. But that's perfect. But I believe, I mean, I had a dog, Nepenthe, Pumpkin, who I know took a heart attack for me. She ended up with bacterial endocarditis, which, if you're familiar with that, that's an infection on the heart valve. That usually does not go very well. Mm-hmm. But she had a lot of lessons for me. One was like, Mom, you better chill out and see what's going on around you and take care of yourself. And the other was, is that she is the one that taught me about the value of whole food diets. Mm-hmm. And she is the one I followed on ultrasound and watched a lesion this big on her heart valve shrink down to the size, tiny. You know, the width of a piece of paper over 3 months. And I'd done all the conventional stuff, and that was life-saving for her. She needed the antibiotics and all that stuff. But I took her with me to the Qi Institute when I was learning acupuncture and Chinese medicine. She would not take acupuncture needles. She thought the herbal formulas were pretty okay, and she thought the home cooking was an outstanding idea. but she proved to me. I mean, so she had this at 9. She lived to be 13, and she did eventually die, actually, of kidney disease. But she proved to me the value and the curative ability of just feeding real whole food diets.
Yeah.
So will you tell us some about your journey to being a veterinarian, and then how you became interested in learning more and involving all these other practices and all this other learning?
Sure. So I mean, at 12, I knew I wanted to be a veterinarian. And so interestingly, I'd actually been training in classical voice for years. And wow. It's like, do I want to be locked in a room learning librettos and all of that kind of stuff, or do I want to go help animals? And it's like, I want to go do that. And so I went through college. I went to a little college called Warren Wilson that had a work study program, had a working small farm there. So pigs and cattle, and we grew everything that fed the animals and the whole nine yards. So it was really amazing to learn that. But that's part of what got me started into veterinary medicine. I thought, I want to go work with, do a mixed animal practice, and quickly realized that large animal medicine was more about the numbers than the animals. So like, all right, no, we'll scratch that part off the list. But that's where I got into veterinary school in North Carolina State, went through the program there, started practicing. I actually went in with the intention of learning more about herbal medicine and being able to apply that. I'd read, Juliette Barclay Levy's books and Dr. Pitcairn's book and Dr. Billinghurst's book. And that's kind of where I thought it was heading. And lo and behold, life waylaid me. And I woke up 15 years later, in 2005, like, holy smokes, how did I get here? And boy, did I swallow the Kool-Aid. And so I started figuring out what I was saying to people on a daily basis, what was actually true, and what was just, for lack of a better descriptor, drug company propaganda. And so I went through that. As I told you, Nepenthe is the one that helped me learn about whole foods. I had another dog, Arnold, who lived to be 17. And what was so hard for him, with him, is that here was this beautiful English setter. His body was worn out. He was still wrapped up here, but his body just couldn't do anything more. And I didn't have anything else for him. So I made a promise to him that I would find other ways to help other pets. And that's what started me down the traditional Chinese medicine path. So went through Qi Institute's acupuncture certification, Chinese veterinary herbology, food therapy course, achieved all of those certifications. And that was just doing amazing stuff. Started studying functional medicine in 2011 and 12. I did the Institute for Functional Medicine's course, week-long course, which is designed for MDs and acupuncturist NDs, and that was like mind-blowing, because again, here's another system of medicine that, instead of looking at your dog has kidney disease, we're going to do this and this and this, it was a way to look at, why does your dog have kidney disease? What are the underlying mechanisms behind this happening? And figuring out different ways to support that pet, that dog, that cat, with supplements, whole foods, et cetera, et cetera, so that we're not just relying on a bag of highly processed garbage and then waiting for things to get worse. So that's it in a nutshell. So
that's an amazing journey. Yeah, it's so amazing. Because it's like, I understand why veterinarians don't seek additional education, because I honestly don't know where you would find the time.
Or money sometimes.
Yeah, because it's so much out there. But it's so amazing, you know, just from my perspective as, you know, a pet parent, where just reading up on all of the modalities and the things that you can learn is all just completely and utterly fascinating.
Yeah. And well, thank God I had insomnia. So that's that's what let me keep working 60 hours a week, plus do the studying for these courses. But yeah, but it's just, I mean, you're right. And that's the problem with for so many of my colleagues is that we got further and further down that human path of, you know, a 15-minute appointment, and then I think they're shaved down to like 6 or 7 minutes at this point. There's just no way you can do a dog any justice that has critical problem or chronic problems going on. So it's just horrifying. We just don't have good options.
Yeah. Well, that's what
for most of my conventional colleagues. Yeah.
No, someone asked me recently if I would ever offer like consultations for just, you know, helping people who want to start raw feeding. And I was just like, you know, I'll get on the phone with you and brainstorm and share with you what I do, but I don't feel comfortable doing consult. Because the beauty of a really just a veterinarian that has a wide range of tools in their toolkit is you can be having this conversation with them and you get comfortable and you start sharing things that you don't think are a big deal. But it turns out that what you're sharing is a symptom of something. And that's not so I don't have that skill set. And that's one thing that I very much appreciate about my former veterinarian. And then I moved to a closer veterinarian. They're traditional vets. And what I love about them is they, not only do they give my dogs a really great exam, but they take the time and explain what they're recommending, showing me everything. And with no pressure, there's no pressure for me to do anything. It's just very much, they want me to be educated. And I so appreciate that.
That is amazing. And that's wonderful that they have maintained their practice, that is the way it gets done. Because that's what's supposed to happen, right? You're supposed to, as a veterinarian, I'm supposed to have given your pet a very physical, a thorough physical examination, and then explain to you what I saw and make sure that you understand it. And it's not all in doctor talk, which we're notoriously bad at. So that's fantastic. That is just, I mean, that's the goal.
So I know that you created the Croc Pet Diet. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. So it's based on the concepts of traditional Chinese medicine and functional medicine. And what I was trying to do was figure out a way that people could home cook consistently as a way to get into a whole foods diet. And as the name sort of implies, you can use a crock pot or slow cooker to do it.
That's my seed.
Right on. Well, and you know, and it's kind of like the earlier videos, I'm a lazy cook. And so I'm like cutting stuff up in small enough chunks to get it in the pan and get it done. Because at one point, my wife, Mary Jo, and I, we had 5 dogs and 5 cats. The dogs ranged in size from 9 pounds to 75 pounds, but we could knock out food for a month in 4 hours. Wow. And get it all frozen. And that's from, you know, getting it ready to the cleaning up the last pan. And that's the deal, is what can you do to make this doable for you and on a consistent basis? And because that is the part that's so critical. Yeah. So from there, kind of everything else came, but that's it.
I love that. A lot of people want to do better and want to feed better, but whether it be the financial aspect of it, because food is expensive, or the time aspect of it. And it's interesting. When I first started writing about raw feeding, I had someone send me an email telling me, because I used to write about, this is what I spent this month. And they were like, please stop doing that. And I'm just like, but I want people to know what it costs. And they're like, I don't know where you live, but you are spending way too much and you are scaring people. And I was just like, really? And at the time I was, because I was brand new to raw. I was super excited at having discovered this way to heal my dog. And I was spending so much money every month. And today I spend a fraction of that. I still don't write about how much I spend, but I spend a fraction of that because I was able to figure it out.
Right on. And that's exactly it. How do you dial it in to make it work for you consistently? And so mm-hmm. for some people, you know, and ultimately too, the deal is there is no one way. It's what works best for your dog. And so the simple first step may be simply to go out and get some vegetables and add it to your dog's kibble and then experiment with things. Does, you know, is that working? Is that creating the type of stool quality you want to see? Is your dog feeling better? And then feel your way through to what the right thing is for your dog. But yeah, there's ways to do it cheaply and there's ways to do it really lavishly. And
yes.
I will admit I'm more of a convenience person than a budget person.
Yeah. And that's it. I mean, you know, what's going to make it work?
Yeah. Well, that's what's so funny is that I always tell people if I had one small dog, I would be doing commercial raw all the way. And I wouldn't, because people are like, well, you really like doing meal prep. And I do. I'm going to do meal prep today. I enjoy it. I've found after 10 years, I have a very simple system for meal prep and it goes really fast. So yeah, it doesn't bother me. It's fine. But when I see other people's meal prep compared to my own, where it's just sort of like this countertop filled with trays of individual meals and all. And I'm just sort of like, I'm exhausted just looking at this 30 second video on Instagram. And I just can't. And it's just like, it's so much. And I mean, but I love that this is what I see. So my question to you is, you've basically watched this journey as well, where, you know, social media was, you know, when I first joined Facebook, I don't even remember what Facebook was really about. It was, you know, we all came from MySpace and Facebook was a new thing. So we're like, this is what we're doing. But I do remember just the opinions. I mean, that was like my memory is like, if you posted anything, you had to be prepared to get everyone's advice and opinions on what you posted. Even if like the most, now I have a puppy. You post a picture of your cute puppy, you are going to get 50 comments telling you how to raise that puppy. Right. But diet, for me at least, wasn't really a conversation that people were having. But today, it's so common and raw feeding feels so mainstream. I mean, the Farmer's Dog, which I mean, it's a cooked food brand, they had a commercial at the Super Bowl. So it's right. Like we've gone from this, like, I can't believe you would feed your dog raw meat. Is your dog going to be feral? To the Super Bowl. What are your thoughts on this journey that we've gone through?
Well, I think, you know, I think you got to look at the very first pet food recall in 2007, right? Because that was the crux of, oh, we really can't trust them, the pet food manufacturers, because, oh my God, that was a nightmare because they were like every week, it was a new brand. And then it turns out, oh wait, these are all canned foods. And oh, they're all made at the same plant in Kansas, whether it was like Friskies or, what was that one that's since been bought out? Innovative Pet Foods, canned food, right? Mm-hmm. Really high dollar stuff that was already $1.50 a can, which was astronomical in 2007. And now if you can find something for $1.50 in a can, you're really lucky, right? But I think
that's Alpo.
Right, exactly. I mean, Alpo in the 70s was actually pretty awesome. But that's the thing. That is what created consumer distrust of the pet food industry, because a lot of what is wrong was exposed. And so it started from there. And it also created the hypersensitivity of, I found this way that worked for my dog, so this must be the only way. And I think that's part of where this escalation of stuff going on in Facebooklandia got a little uglier. But that's it. I think from 2007, it's like, oh, wait, these guys are all lying to us. And now what do we do? And that's the tough part.
Yeah. And I feel sad. You know, one thing that I used to do, and I always call them born again raw feeders, people who are new to raw feeding. and they discovered, you know, like their dog was so sick, and now their dog is running around like he's, you know, a puppy again. And so they are so passionate. And so they're just harassing everyone. You know, I had, there was a woman here in my town that was basically standing in the kibble aisle of Costco and lecturing people about buying kibble and telling them you should go over to the meat and get the meat. And we have a local pet store in my town, and I walked into the pet store probably an hour after her latest assault on strangers. And everyone turns and looks at me, and I'm like, what? And they were like, were you just at Costco? And I was like, no, I'm going there after this. And they're like, because there's a woman at Costco standing in that aisle. I'm like, why do you think it's me? I would never do that. It's horrifying. Why would I do that? But to be perfectly honest, when I was new to raw feeding, I still wouldn't have done that, but I would have wanted to.
I still want to.
I know. I mean, I was more passive aggressive about things, where I would pick up something, look at it, turn and look at the ingredients, and then make a face like, oh no, and then put it down and hope someone notices and ask me what I saw. And I would stand in an aisle for a while. Every time someone came back, okay, time to do it again. That was me. It was pathetic, but I did have a couple of conversations. But yeah, it's like these born again raw feeders who want everyone to do the same thing. And I have learned since then to just meet people where they are and understand that, you know, not everyone's going to do what I do. I get a kick out of it, and this is fun for me, but for an average person who has a full-on family, a full-time job outside of the home, kids, you know, doing hours of meal prep is just not an option for them.
Hey, quick question for you. Are you someone who wants to be fit, healthy, and happy? And what if I told you could get your dream body by simply just listening to a podcast? I'm Josh.
And I'm KG, and we're the hosts of the Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast.
Listen, we get it. Fitness isn't easy. Carbs, no carbs.
Just stop, okay? It doesn't have to be that complicated. And that's why we made this podcast. We get straight to the facts so you can become your best you.
So the way to check us out is click the link in the show notes or search Fit, Healthy, and Happy podcast on any of the major podcast platforms. We'll see you soon.
Right. And that's kind of the thing is, you know, they need to be doing the meal prep for their family too. And so, you know, what can we do to help the dogs out as well? But that, I appreciate your brutal honesty about wanting to be that evangelistic person. And believe me, I got on my high horse too. I mean, I was showing ultrasound pictures and all of that stuff to my clients. So I totally get you. But you're right. It's kind of like, there's this whole thing that once we figure out something that's worked for us personally, we got to tell everybody about it. And I think that's good to help expose others, but you know, to the point where you're like preaching in the aisle of Costco, that's getting a little weird.
At least we can just start podcasts now.
Yes, yes.
We're going to talk about this on the podcast.
Let's get down. I mean, but it's crazy, right? Because if you have a business that's online, people that run your social media accounts are talking about brand evangelism. I'm like, what? But that's kind of the degree of commitment. Let's say that. Yeah. We'll leave it at that nice word. Yeah.
Is diet the number one most important change for pet parents to make to get their dogs healthier? Is that where it all has to start? Like, you know, it's like you can't feed kibble and then do acupuncture and think that those will balance out, right? Like it has to be diet first.
Well, so let's put it in terms of what most humans think about. So let's say Joe is say 40 and he just went to the doctor and his doc says, oh, Joe, your H1AC is elevated, which means you're pre-diabetic. Joe's eating the standard American diet of McDonald's three to five times a week. And he's drinking a six pack of beer every night. And he's like, all right, doc, what do I got to do? And so, you know, doc tells him about the diet and you could probably start taking some metformin. So what does Joe do? Joe takes the metformin, but doesn't change his diet. And then 6 months later, Joe's now going to be taking insulin injections because he didn't change his diet. So that's kind of a gross overstatement, but truly it's not. If you don't change the root cause of what causes so many chronic diseases, which is inflammation, by changing what you're feeding your dog, you cannot outpill that bad diet. So yeah. It's tough, really tough. But yes, always, 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 this is the first step. And this is one of the next things for me was I was doing one-to-one consultations with folks up until, probably 22, and realized that, you know, to your point, Kimberly, there's so many wonderful vets out there, but there's so many vets that just don't have time and people don't have access to that trusted guide. And so what I realized is that we can train people to understand basics of how to coach people through these issues. And this is always where we start, is with diet. If you're feeding Beneful, you're not going to make them better unless you change to something else.
Yeah. I mean, I have friends who have dogs, you know, we're talking about ages, who lived 17, 18 years old, and they're kibble fed dogs, but they also get fresh food because they get table scraps and things like so. And it's one of those things where my friends don't even think about that. They're just like, oh, well, you know, why would I feed raw? I feed kibble and my dogs live this long. But when they think about the fact that, no, you are actually also adding fresh food. I watch you do it. You do it all the time. The treats you give your dogs are really great treats. Plus, I live in a rural area, so everyone lives on land. So their dogs are running around outside all day, every day. So it's just sort of like, you know, it's, I think when it comes to diet, I think we often, or at least I know I do, immediately jump to raw and cooked. And I think that's where the evangelism comes from, because we forget that there are baby steps all the way up there. Because I think many of us, when we first got dogs, you know, we hear about someone making food in a crock pot or adding an egg to the meal, and we slowly start, oh, I can do that. And it's like building up to the point where now we're ready to move into fresh food.
Right on. And the thing is, too, is that for years, my profession shamed our clients for adding in the leftover green beans, the leftover vegetables. And that was actually what was probably saving so many dogs' lives, because they're giving them the table scraps. Now, I'll tell you, probably the pizza bones aren't a great idea to add in so much. Yeah. But everything else that you're eating, if your family's eating healthy home-cooked food, or real, you know, real vegetables, real meats, all of that stuff, and you give your dog the leftovers, that you're only benefiting that dog. And so you're right. Baby steps, baby steps. What can you do one piece at a time?
You know, one thing that I noticed is, you know, I also work for a local rescue, and we have had quite a few people try the cooked brands, and then all of a sudden their dogs are developing pancreatitis. And I have my theory as to why this is happening. And it's basically, I wonder if they are microwaving the food and then feeding it to their dogs. So they're basically oxidizing any fat that might be in the food and then feeding it to their dog over a period of time. Do you have any insight into why a commercial cooked diet could lead to pancreatitis?
That's interesting. And I hadn't heard that, but yeah, I could definitely buy into the idea of microwaving. The other thing is, because coconut oil is so popular, that chronic use of coconut oil has been associated with pancreatitis. And then the other thing is, too, is that so environmentally, we're putting this stuff into a plastic package, freezing it and shipping it across the country. And we already know that, for instance, the Great Lakes are so contaminated with microplastics, and the fish coming out of the Great Lakes are. And probably if we start looking in all of our water sources, we're going to see a lot of microplastics. So if you're nuking the dog food, or your food for that matter, in a plastic bag of stuff, that's not good. Yeah. But yeah, I could buy into that.
I didn't even
think
to ask if they're nuking it into, because I mean, even I had to stop, we have a microwave oven. I had to stop using it because
Yeah, we just sit stuff on top of ours. We
don't. It's decorative. So
in a plastic container, and you're supposed to just put it in the plat, and it's just sort of like, what is this doing to me?
Not good things. So the total utilization I had of a microwave was to defrost things inside of it so that the cats would not attack it.
That's a good idea.
Yeah, but I think, you know, if you're not familiar with what microwaves do to food, just Google microwave altering protein structures, and I think you'll freak yourself out and stop using a microwave.
I remember getting our first microwave when I was like 5 years old, and I remember my grandmother like being very concerned about it, and she would be like, don't stand near it. And my parents thought she was totally nuts, and now I'm like, oh my God, I think my grandmother was right.
She was. And it, you know, and so it's creating waves, and I think the scatter on those things is something like 10 feet. So it's like, yeah.
Yeah.
Grandma was right.
Wow, even a broken clock is right twice a day, huh? That's what I'll say about my grandmother.
There you go. And then you can get out your tinfoil hat and really be complete, yeah.
Hey, we talk about that too. So Kimberly alluded, you know, both she and I do a lot of volunteer work in the shelter and rescue communities. And I heard you have a conversation with Ruby on the Feed Real page about early spay neuter and about the problem with spay neuter. And this is something, you know, Kimberly and I have talked about on the podcast before because, you know, I do pit bull rescue here in Baltimore. You know, Kimberly's on the board of a rescue. And sometimes, you know, I shudder when I think of like all of the assaults, you know, that go on a dog when they come into a shelter. They're getting hit with all these vaccines, they're getting hit with all these chemicals, they're getting, you know, this physical trauma to their body with this, you know, spay neuter surgery, you know, and like sometimes they're taking little puppies and, you know, essentially throwing them into menopause when they're just a few weeks or months old. And would you talk to us a little bit about the effects of spay neuter on the body and what we can do to help our dogs that have had this done?
Right on. So first thing I want to say is in 1993, when I bought my first practice in South Carolina, the local SPCA was taking in 45,000 dogs and cats every year and euthanizing 38,000 of them.
Ugh.
So just step one. So this is a double-edged sword. We solved that problem, or we're on our way to solving that problem. That's horrifying that we were killing so many dogs and cats because we could not find them homes. However, and I get it. I mean, I'm a guilty party. You know, let's get those gonads out of there before the dog or cat has a chance to reproduce. But what we're doing is exactly as you said. We're throwing them into menopause right off the rip. They are never endocrine competent. And so the deal is what can we do to help prevent that from being an issue? I think what needs to happen in the profession is some research on physiologic hormone replacement therapy, which hopefully something will be happening, or at least something to cut off the mechanism, which I'm going to explain a little bit more in detail. So Michelle Kutzler out of Oregon, University of Oregon Corvallis Veterinary School, she's a theriogenologist, and she's the one that elucidated that dogs and cats that are spayed and neutered have luteinizing hormone levels that are 20 to 30 times normal for intact animals. The other issue is that tissues that should not have receptors for luteinizing hormone do. And these tissues are the ones where all the chronic disease is happening, the brains, the adrenal glands, the kidneys, the liver, the gut, the bones, the joints, the bone marrow. And so we're ending up with this epidemic of cognitive dysfunction, anxiety, adrenal disease, whether it's Cushing's or Addison's, allergies, arthritis, all of this stuff that's just making our dogs miserable. And the big one is cancer, to the point where the American Veterinary Cancer Society says 50% of dogs over the age of 10 will develop a malignant cancer. I mean, that's insanity, absolute insanity, right? So, all right, we know the problem's there. We don't have a solution yet. So what can you do to help your pet out right now? One is, feed real food, and especially focus on brassica vegetables that will help the liver function better. The liver, amongst its many other jobs, helps us remove excess levels of hormone, so it will help bring that level of luteinizing hormone down. And the other thing will be to make sure that the microbiome is working extremely well so that the gut can assist with detoxification and spare some of the effort on that the liver is making. And then one of the other things I really think is important is to take a like feeds like concept. And essentially that means feeding glandular materials, so ovaries, testicles, that do not contain hormones to pets, so that we can help support them in their ability to make physiologic levels of these sex hormones, estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And then if you're familiar with Dr. David Bieber, who has a website called Dogsterone, he is teaching other veterinarians how to use testosterone injections for dogs that have arthritis or the frailties of aging. And that's what the FDA says, that veterinarians can use testosterone and other anabolic steroids for. So in fact, when I first got out in practice in 1990, we used to use Winstrol V for aged cats and for cats with feline leukemia. And that is an anabolic steroid. Helped them feel better. But this would be a solution to shut off the production of luteinizing hormone by cutting off the mechanism that stems from the hypothalamus down the pituitary and then to the adrenal glands. Does that make any sense?
Because I see all these like 2-year-old pit bull dogs that are tearing their CCLs. And I'm always like, this is what it is. There's a huge epidemic of that happening. And I'm like, it's all from this spay neuter situation. And what is exactly the role of luteinizing hormone in like a healthy, normal situation?
So in an intact dog, person, cat, mammal, luteinizing hormone helps the ovaries to prepare the eggs to get ready to turn into mature follicles to be released into the uterus. And then in the male animals, it helps to prepare the sperm so that they're ready to be the good little swimmers and get out there and mate with the eggs to create new mammals. So whether that's puppies, children, what have you. And those, you know, if you're spayed or neutered, or you've gone through andropause or menopause, you don't need those functions any longer. And so theoretically, the luteinizing hormone levels should drop. So.
Mm-hmm. And so right. What do you think about the modified surgeries, such as like an ovary sparing spay or like a vasectomy? Would those be more helpful?
They're fantastic. I mean, that's because essentially, and this is the difficulty in the United States, that would be a fantastic solution because we solve both the pet overpopulation problem and we prevent the chronic disease that we're seeing in epidemic proportions right now. The difficulty is that U.S. society is not set up to deal with these pets that are intact in terms of how they behave, how they respond to each other, because we humans don't understand how to teach our dogs the manners to deal with their hormones, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So like in the EU, I mean, and if you've been over here or in Mexico, there are plenty of animals that are running around intact, but they've learned how to be polite and, you know, and respect each other. And most pet parents here have learned, you know, no, this is acceptable behavior. And if my dog is in heat, we're not going to go walking through the town square because that's just going to create all sorts of disturbances.
We have a local dog park and I met a woman who just moved here from Holland And she was talking about Americans, our reaction, and sorry, that's Bella, reaction to her dog who hasn't been neutered. And she was just like, people are really, and we're just laughing about it. It's like, yeah, we are just not equipped to handle, because we've been, you know, fed. Well, we've been force fed the fact that kibble is king and you spay and neuter as soon as possible and you vaccinate on a regular basis. And it's like all of these things where she's from, it's so much more evolved that, and she was saying, we only spay or neuter if there is a health issue that right. doing that surgery would alleviate. She's like, otherwise we just don't bother. And, right. and they still take their dog's places, you know, I mean, they adapt and adjust based on the dog, but they can still take their dog's places and they don't have the overpopulation that we have.
That's it. And so this is a difference in cultural norms, partly. The other difficulty in the U.S. is that if you need to go to a dog park with some regularity or a boarding kennel or doggy daycare, something like this, many of these places will not allow you to bring your intact dog in, intact dog into their facility because the insurance companies won't give them insurance. Mm. Because again, most of us don't know how to deal with intact pets. And so when we started talking about this again, I had to really stretch back in my memory, like, oh yeah, what happens when a dog goes through heat? And, you know, to help explain to my clients what they can expect and in terms yeah. of how the behavior will be different. So it is something that's very cultural, but unfortunately we've created a litany of woes because of our, you know, it's taking to the party line. So for instance, in women, if you have ovarian cysts, most of the time the doctors will say, if you're at risk for ovarian cancer, they'll want to go in and take both ovaries. Well, probably 7 years ago, there was a paper published that said, when you do that to a woman below the age of 64, you have just shortened her life by 4 years, period.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And guess where the ovarian cancer actually comes from? The fallopian tubes.
Ooh.
So I had this, and the reason I know all this is because I had an ovarian cyst and I had to argue with my doctor and actually send her the paper that said, do not take both ovaries. You know, and yeah. This is the difficulty, is that medicine changes so slowly. Even when it's crystal clear that the standard of care is not for the benefit of the patient.
How do you suggest pet parents have conversations with their veterinarians who might not be on board? Is it just go find a new vet? That's what I've had to do anyway.
Well, and that's it. I mean, so you're in a relatively metropolitan area, so you have that luxury. If you're in Winslow, Oklahoma, maybe you don't. Maybe you only have one vet in town. And so what you have to do is keep smiling, keep breathing, and say, Doc, you know, I've been reading this stuff, and send them papers so that you can show them that you're not just reading this stuff on Facebook. But there is a terrific amount of research out there, and ask them if they're willing to do either an ovary sparing spay or a vasectomy, essentially. Many docs are not. And it's a little bit of a trick to learn some of these techniques, but not terribly difficult. I had one of my students elected to do an ovary sparing spay for her dog, who was at 8 months old. And it literally cost her two times as much as a regular spay. And
wow.
I don't think the procedure is as difficult as all of that, but this is not what, anyway, it is what it is. So there's that conversation. The drug that is used in EU, Central and South America is vetorelin, which is a gonadotropin releasing hormone blocker. And it is a pellet that is injected under the skin. What this does is in an intact dog, it prevents the release of GnRH, that gonadotropin releasing hormone, which stops the reproduction of estrogen, progesterone, testosterone. So it makes, it's essentially a chemical castration, if you will. But the pellet only lasts for somewhere between 6 and 12 months. In the US, it is not available except for ferrets. But there are veterinarians that have used it off-label, which means that it's not approved for that species dog in the U.S. by the FDA, but it is in other countries. The ferret pellet, by the way, works for 6 months for dogs. So that is an option that doesn't require any special surgical technique. It is reversible as well and produces sterility so that that dog cannot reproduce. So that's another question you could ask about as well.
Oh, well, I've never heard of that.
I know. Before we let you go, I was wondering if you could tell us more about your pet health coach certification program. Like, who is that for, and what made you come up with something like that? Because it looks so intensive and pretty awesome.
I would be delighted to. So as I alluded to, I was getting super frustrated, especially around COVID, because people could not get help. And so, like human health coaches, what they've been trained to do is learn how to support you with potential lifestyle health issues, lifestyle-related health issues, by adapting your diet, by using different supplements, by using different tests to help figure out what the root cause of some of these challenges are. And same concept. What I've done is take basically as much of my brains and dump them into a 16-week course where I'm training passionate pet parents and pet pros to be the trusted guide for pet parents. And the reason is that the access to care is horrific right now. It's so difficult. My colleagues are drowning trying to keep up. And this is not going to get better anytime soon, sadly. I think that Mars Veterinary Care did a study, and they estimate that by 2030, we will be 24,000 companion animal veterinarians short of being able to serve the projected need, which is really, really scary. So we need a third profession, or we need a third provider in the profession. This will take my colleagues 10 to 20 years to figure out. So in the meantime, I've created this training course. It is qualified for 40 hours of continuing education credit for vets and vet techs. And what we do is basically teach people concepts of functional medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, how to understand common chronic disease conditions from a conventional medicine perspective, and also how to make this a business, how to make this a livelihood. But my goal is to get coaches out there supporting pet parents. And we're seeing these guys make massive, massive changes in pet parents and pets' lives.
Yeah, I have looked at that program several times. I'm very interested in it myself. Is there any type of prerequisite or, you know, educational or vocational background that people should have?
No, and it's interesting. So we're working with everybody from pet parents that have been really involved in rescue and have seen the need for, you know, just what you were describing. I mean, these guys go through a huge number of physical and probably emotional challenges just getting through the ringers of going through the rescue, all the way up to two veterinarians and veterinary technicians. But we've had many groomers, pet dog walkers, people that have pet shops. And these are folks that are seeing the changes that are happening with your pet on a weekly and monthly basis. So there's no prerequisites. The course is self-contained. You'd get assigned a mentor, a one-to-one mentor for calls to help you get through the material, understand what's going on. And then we also do weekly coaching calls for the group itself. So it's been a super, super program.
I love the fact that we have so many amazing programs that are out there and available to us, because, you know, I keep hearing about the, you know, like the veterinarian shortage, and then also because clinics have shortened the amount of time that they can spend with their patients. It's nice to be able to do a lot of, what's the word? Triage at home. I mean, I did that with Rodrigo before he passed away. I was able to see, you know, like, oh, my pale gums, you know, and understand all of these little things and knew what I could do to support him before we got to the vet, you know, and because, you know, PetMD and just the internet in general is a dangerous place when your dog is sick at 8 o'clock at night. And so,
yes. On a Saturday, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Right so on. Right
I
on.
I love the idea that not only can we be empower ourselves, but there are other people out there that we can reach out to until we can get to a veterinarian.
Right on. And that's kind of the cool thing too, is that several of the coaches that have graduated are working with local veterinarians to do the education piece. Like, you know, let's take that same dog that just got diagnosed with kidney disease at the vet's office. They're like, oh, feed the bag of food and come back in 3 months. And if the parent says, isn't there anything else? Then these really smart vets are saying, yes, call this person and she'll guide you through how to make a diet that is complete and balanced for all life stages, the magic words that every veterinarian wants to hear and say, and other things you can do to support the kidney disease. So it's just so much potential to help pets and really and pet parents too.
What has been the veterinarian's response? Are they welcoming to having this kind of option?
I gotta tell you also, before the Feed Real meeting was the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association meeting, and I was there to meet and greet and do a little talk with CBD Dog Health. I was scared because I had no idea how this was going to go. And the reception I got was like, wow, that's a great idea. So it was like,
oh, I'm glad to hear
but
that.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, but it, but the thing that's cool is that for my coaches is, they're working with conventional vets who see the need for alternative options, but they don't have the time or bandwidth to go learn the material. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just, I think it's going to grow. It's a concept that is so new to the veterinary profession. It's going to take a little while for folks to really understand what it is and how it can best be utilized, both in a practice setting and going to seek out a health coach privately as well.
Well, I'll make sure we include links in the show notes for our listeners who want to learn more about that.
That would be awesome. Yeah. It's yeah. And so that's the cool thing on the website. If you need somebody to help you with this, we've got a page that's set up dedicated to connecting you with the graduated coaches. And also we'll get some information about how to apply to the program to learn more about it as well, to see if that's a good fit for you.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today.
It is my pleasure. Really fun hanging with you guys.